We'd like to go ahead and get started this afternoon. The subject of the afternoon is to look into greater detail the mission that we've gone over this morning. The first paper, the first hour or so, will be concerned with a discussion of the navigation guidance and control concepts, with a little bit of discussion concerning the hardware, to the extent that the hardware interacts with the mission concepts. It's okay.
I don't think they realized you were starting.
We couldn't afford any more slippages in the programs. Later on, we'll be discussing in considerable depth this afternoon launch through lunar orbit of the mission. And the mission is has now evolved in that phase. And the last paper this afternoon, as far as I'm concerned, one of the real highlights of the three-day program is a detailed discussion of the lunar excursion module descent. I might say that the question often arises is with respect to the navigation and guidance and control requirements. How accurate must the guidance system be in order to perform the mission? And there's no specific answer to this because there's a trade-off between guidance performance and weight. Fuel weight, and in some cases, weight of other elements of the system. I'm thinking specifically of such things as landing gear weight with respect to the translational and vertical velocity with which one actually touches down on the lunar surface. To date, we have pretty well frozen our hardware concepts throughout the vehicle systems, both in the command module and the LEM. We've sized the tanks. The work that's been going on now, and that will continue to go on until the actual landing is made, is to make better use of the equipment that we now have on hand, to make better use of the fuel that we have available. We sized the tanks with sufficient fuel margins, for example, based upon the hardware performance as we saw it, the guidance and control hardware performance as we saw it at that stage of the game, to provide a certain margin of safety. And the general trends that we've been seeing is that through better concepts, through better simulations, through better understanding of how we should go about the mission, at what points we should make trajectory corrections and so forth, we've been able to build up our safety margins in fuel. The question often arises, too, as to what has Surveyor, has Luna, have Gemini had any significant impact upon our guidance and control concepts on the overall Apollo mission concepts. As the program began about 5 years ago, almost exactly 5 years ago, as a matter of fact, there were a few here who had the good fortune to be at Kennedy on the 25th of May when they rolled out the great big vehicle, which was precisely the five-year date from the time President Kennedy declared that this nation would go to the moon in this decade. So we're halfway there time-wise, and I'd say from a conceptual standpoint and from a hardware standpoint, we're about three-fourths of the way there. The results of the Surveyor missions have confirmed many of the concepts that we'd provided for in the LEM. The general approach that was taken at the beginning 5 years ago was to work with in the vehicle design and in establishing the fuel requirements in laying down the landing gear criteria in establishing the guidance strategy, the landing strategy, was to provide a large bound of uncertainty depending upon how the knowledge of the environment evolved during this period of a decade, in which all the other programs would support the improvement of this knowledge. And I think in general, the lunar results and the surveyor results and the Gemini results have shown that the Apollo design, the Apollo concepts, have been within this bound on generally on the conservative side. That is, we have more margins than were provided for in many cases. I think the one possible, the one situation where we were working on kind of the lack of conservative side was with respect to some of the visibility problems that we've encountered. Contamination of windows, of optical elements, some of the problems associated with peculiar lighting conditions on the lunar surface, and these will be discussed in some depth in the next couple of days. And I'd like to call attention to a display that John Dornbach has in the little room right outside here of the lunar surface model, in which he projects the simulated sun onto this, and you can see how the surface, how the pilot's ability to discern the surface varies very much as a function of the angle between the angle at which you're looking and the angle at which the sun is located. In general, we've frozen the hardware designs, and we've tried to retain the flexibility to incorporate new learning and to incorporate new data as it accumulates into the software. And of course, there reaches a point in the program where you must start freezing software concepts and designs also. And in the earliest missions, of course, these have been. We've already reached those stages. I think the significant, there have been many significant things that have fallen out of the Gemini program, many of which many of you are not aware of. Things which have helped the design conceptually as well as hardware-wise in Apollo, particularly in the guidance control systems. I'd like to cite, for example, one thing that's come out of the last three missions. We've determined the great desirability on the part of the crew of having, on the eight ball, of having local vertical indication throughout the rendezvous maneuver. Now, in Apollo, we were planning for inertial indication. You can rendezvous with an inertial 8-ball, or you can rendezvous with a local vertical 8-ball. But in Gemini, we've shown that the ability, the time loading on the crew is considerably less with the local vertical 8-ball. And also, the number of initial conditions that one can accommodate and have a fixed set of routines that he carries out in the rendezvous is much broader if he uses a local vertical 8-ball. So this is a fallout into Apollo that that should make it so that we have less tired astronauts after the Apollo mission than we would have before. These are ways in which one increases his margin of safety, with one ways in which we make the mission easier as a result of other program inputs. I'd like to, at the outset, very briefly talk about the hardware of the system and the guidance and control concepts in Apollo. And maybe it'd be well to define the navigation, guidance, and control system. The purpose of the guidance system is to control the position and velocity of the vehicle. The navigation process is the process of determining your position. The guidance process is the process of controlling the location of the center of mass in accordance with some predetermined strategy. This shows a very generalized diagram of a guidance and control system. In order to minimize errors, the system must reduce the effects of interfering quantities, and it must respond very quickly to command signals. The guidance system operates as a force vector control system. That is, the system must change the direction and magnitude of controllable forces, namely lift, drag, and thrust, in such a way that the vehicle reaches its desired point in space and time. It is usual in the theory of dynamics of rigid bodies in three dimensions to separate out control of the center of mass from control of from motions about the center of mass, and this is basically the separation of guidance, the movement of the center of mass, and control motions about the center of mass. The definition of navigation and guidance is open to a certain degree of individual interpretation. Interpretation, of course, is important. You might remember the story about the company of actors touring in Russia doing Uncle Tom's Cabin. They came to a place in the play where little Eva dies and goes to heaven. And since the Russians don't believe in heaven, they had little Eva get well and go to work in a cement factory. This is an indication of differences in interpretations. The guidance and control of all manned spacecraft have involved a mix of onboard systems and of ground systems. The concepts, the guidelines used in the Apollo program from the very outset are shown here. It's mandatory that there be a ground navigation capability provided in Earth orbit, in cislunar space, in lunar orbit, and during the lunar landing phases, and during the lunar rendezvous phases. It's mandatory that the spacecraft have a completely self-contained navigation, guidance, and control capability on board to be used in the event the data link with the ground is lost. And the onboard system is designed in such a way to take the maximum advantage of the ground system and to include all the necessary interfaces. This slide shows the navigation, guidance, and control system, which has evolved for the command module. I'd like to discuss it very briefly. I might say that the most important single element in the guidance and control system is the astronaut. Most of the other things that are there are provided to give him indications, to provide him information on which he can make judgments, to provide the tools for which he can introduce these judgments into the system. The navigation, guidance, and control configuration shows the manned spaceflight network, the up data link, which provides the state vector to the Apollo guidance computer, the AGC. And of course, the MSFN is tied to the Mission Control Center here at Houston. There's also a data link via voice communication. The AGC, the computer, is a very important central element of the guidance and control system. It receives information from the scanning telescope, the SCT, the sextant, the SXT, and by way of DISCIs, which are display and keyboards assembly, the mechanism through which the astronaut communicates with the computer and vice versa for a large number of the communications to the astronaut. The stabilization system, an analog stabilization system, is an integral part of the spacecraft. Both the analog stabilization system and the Apollo guidance and computer can drive the reaction control system and the SBS gimbal servos. We have a dual control capability. Under normal circumstances, the digital autopilot system would be in control of the vehicle. But this is subject to selection by the crew on board. Additionally, we have as a backup attitude reference to the primary platform, an SCS attitude reference, and an entry monitor system, which I'll discuss very briefly shortly. Guidance and control system, as far as the hardware is concerned, in both the LEM and the command module is essentially identical. The inertial measurement unit is identical in both vehicles. The computer is identical in both vehicles. The optical elements are different. There is no requirement for a sextant in the LEM, and therefore we have only an an alignment telescope in the LIM optical system. All of the peripheral electronics to support the inertial measurement unit and to tie these elements together, such as coupling data units and platform electronics, are identical in two vehicles. Some of the electronics is packaged slightly different because they're packaged the same at the module level, but at the overall black box level, they're located in different places in the space in the two spacecraft, and therefore they look different from the outside. The stabilization system is shown here, the SCS system for the command module. The basic function of this system is to drive the jet drivers to turn on and off the 100-pound thrusters, and also to direct the gimbals of the service module engine to orient properly the thrust vector of the main engine. Attitude information comes either from the guidance and navigation system or from the attitude gyro and accelerometer package, which is labeled AGAP. Rate information comes from the rate gyro package, the RGP, and is displayed on the display panel. Rate and attitude information is used in conjunction with the manual controller to control the attitude jets and to control the main engine gimbals. The attitude jets can be controlled through two paths, as can be seen from this simplified diagram. One path via the dead band limiter, pseudo rate logic, and jet select logic to the jet drivers. The term pseudo rate means that the output of the switching amplifier, which is an on-off device, commands vehicle acceleration, which neglects the reaction jet time delays and neglects the dynamics of the system. The short period output of this signal through a lag filter is indicative of the vehicle rate. The gains and time constant have been selected for the Apollo SCS to provide the desired signal for an average vehicle inertia throughout the lunar mission. The configuration of the pseudo rate feedback for the Apollo SCS has been developed for limit cycle operation. During maneuvers, the effective feedback should be to pulse the jets prior to the commanded maneuver rate being achieved, thus resulting in somewhat of an overdamped kind of response. To avoid this sort of thing, the pseudo rate feedback is switched out during manual maneuvers. The GNN system is located in the lower equipment bay of the spacecraft, and this slide shows in a cutaway about the location. It doesn't give very much detail. The guidance and navigation equipment is shown in a handling figure in a handling fixture in this particular slide, which shows the Block 1 configuration. Here we can make out the essential elements which are there in both the Block 1 and Block 2 versions. Here is a panel which incorporates the scanning telescope, which is a one-power, rather wide field of vision optical instrument, and the sextant, which is a 28-power, narrow field of vision instrument. The various GNN controls for the navigator in the crew. Incidentally, the navigator in the crew is the number two man in the crew. For example, Ed White is the primary navigator in the 204 mission. These are various modules that make up the power and servo assembly. And down below is where the computer is located. Up here are located coupling data units, which generally are analog to digital converters and indicate gimbal angles for the use of the crew. To the right is the face of the DISCI, the display and keyboard assembly, which I'd like to discuss a little bit more a little bit later. This is a schematic diagram of the gimbals of the inertial measurement unit. The stable member houses three single degree of freedom 25 Erig gyros. Each one of these, of course, is sensitive to one direction in space, and with three of them, we're able to maintain a fixed inertial reference with respect to the fixed stars, except They drift very slightly due to the fact that they're manufactured by human beings. And that we don't have all of the... We aren't able to build perfect instruments, although these come as close as most any in the country. Three accelerometers, in this particular case, pulsed integrating pendulous accelerometers, are sensitive in those three orthogonal directions. These specific forces are integrated once to give velocity and integrated twice to give position. And basically, with that platform is a very integral element of the guidance and control system. Given an initial position and with the ability to measure both velocities or to integrate to get velocities and distance, one is able to navigate over the period of time that the system is in operation. Of course, on the long duration mission, such as the lunar mission, we don't navigate with this package. We navigate on board with the optical elements, which are used to align this and which are used to determine the position of the vehicle as it progresses to and from the moon. You might be interested in looking a little bit at the hardware itself. This is the inertial measurement unit. It's very much like a Polaris platform. It has evolved from the Polaris platform. It shows one of the resolver caps removed. The corrugated portion on the outside is the passage through which thermal control is maintained of the inertial measurement unit, and the coolant fluid flows through that particular tube. Here we see the same instrument, the same package with the top removed. The three gimbals, it's a three-gimbaled platform. The platform electronics and the accelerometers and gyros can be made out in this particular photograph. This photograph shows the inertial measurement unit and the optical system, the scanning telescope and the sextant, mounted on a precision navigation base, which maintains a precise angular relationship between these two elements of the guidance and control system. The optical system is used to align the inertial system and is used for navigation in Earth orbit, in cislunar space, and in lunar orbit. The inertial measurement unit is the primary attitude reference and is used for guidance purposes during all maneuvers and during reentry. This picture shows the instrument panel in front of the pilot in the command and service module. The switches in the panel to the right control the propellant for both the RCS and the SPS over in here. The switch and dial at the top indicate the amount of fuel, the quantity of the RCS propellant. I'm sure that not very many of you can make out very many of the details in the back of the room on this. The indicator with curved lines, I guess it's right here, and I can't even see the curved lines myself, is the entry monitor system, which I'd like to discuss a little bit later on, which is a last-ditch guidance system to be used during Earth reentry. Here we see the one of the two FDAI, Flight Director Attitude Indicators, the 8-ball. The needles above, below, and to the right of the 8-ball are error needles. To the left of the FDAI are switches for the SPS system. Directly below the FDAI, right in this area, and down in here, are the delta V remaining counter and thrust and direct ullage switches. And right down at the bottom is the mode select switches for the SCS system. The modes that are available in the SCS system are a monitor mode, a GNN attitude control, GNN delta V, GNN entry, SCS local vertical mode, SCS attitude control, SCS delta V, and SCS reentry. The throttle control is the T-handle, which is kind of cut off toward the left-hand lower corner of the picture. In the middle of that picture was the Disky, and I'd like to show you the faceplate of the Disky and to mention this. This is the display and keyboard assembly. We have two of these in the command module and one in the LEM, and they're identical. They come off the same production line at Raytheon. One of them is located on the instrument panel right in front of the command pilot, and the other is located down in the navigation section in the lower equipment bay, right next to the navigation instruments. This is the mechanism by which the astronaut communicates with the computer. It's designed by MIT and it's built by Raytheon. The computer itself is a very powerful computer with the largest memory of any airborne computer ever built. It has a memory of 40,000 words, 36,000 fixed memory, and 4,000 erasable, each of 16 bits. And it's not far from the computational capability in this little package of an IBM 7090. The Disky makes it possible for the astronaut to monitor system activity, to alter parameters, and to dictate various system modes. In addition, it has indicator lights and status lights. The computer display on the Disky consists of two-digit displays labeled verb, program, and noun. The two-digit displays are coded for various modes and instructions. The program display indicates the major operating mode of the computer, such as the lunar landing maneuver. The verb and noun displays are used together to give meaningful phrases or instructions. For example, the verb might say display value, the verb in the form of a number, such as 28. And the noun would be another number, such as 45, which might be velocity, for that one particular program in which the system is operating, the lunar landing maneuver. The verb might say compute. The noun might say abort velocity. The verb might say read in, and the noun might say landmark angle. And the data is provided to the crew on these EL lights down below. This means that you have the possibility of 100 verbs and 100 nouns for each program. This is 10 to the fourth sentences possible for each program, any one of 100 different programs. I'd like now to talk about the ground system and how it ties in as part of the overall guidance and control system. This is a schematic representation of the MSFN tracking system. The vehicle is illuminated by an 85-foot antenna, which provides range, angles, and velocity. The information is transmitted to the Mission Control Center here in Houston, and information is determined from this data in the computational center. The vehicle can also be tracked by a 30-foot antenna, which uses three-way Doppler information to provide position and velocity data. Distance is determined by modulating the carrier with random digits, 0 and 1. The signal is received by transponders in the command module and in the LEM and retransmitted. The measurement of transit time of the signal is a measure of the distance of the spacecraft. Velocity is determined by measuring the Doppler shift in the signal returned by the spacecraft. Here we see the location of the MSFN stations. I'll not dwell on these. Most of you are familiar with them. Owen showed them earlier in one of his slides. There are 385-foot stations and a number of 30-foot stations spread throughout the world. I'm going to discuss shortly the accuracy of the MSFN system and of the onboard system and show you how they perform throughout the lunar mission. Before doing that, I'd like to discuss the performance of the ground system. And the performance that has been assumed here in this, in the results that I'm going to give for the station characteristics. I want to be sure to identify what we assume to be the characteristics because, as is always the case, there's not always complete agreement on what a system can do. But there ought to be pretty much agreement, assuming that we could agree on the characteristics of the stations. Here we've assumed that the tracking stations, the one sigma tracking errors, are in range, a noise error of 60 feet, and in bias, 120 feet. In angles, a noise error of 8/10 milliradian, and bias, twice that, 1.6 milliradian. Two-way Doppler, noise of 1/10 of a foot per second, and bias of 0.07 feet per second. Three-way Doppler, noise of 1/10 of a foot per second, and bias of 2/10 of a foot per second. The frequency standard is a rubidium frequency standard with a short and long-term stability of 5 times 10 to the minus 11 parts per part. The MSFN stations use either the 30-foot or the 85-foot antenna and can track spacecraft at lunar distances using either the high-gain antenna or omnidirectional antenna. Here we see the various tracking modes summarized for the system, the operating modes. During the Earth orbital phase, the system uses C-band and measures range in two angles. During the cislunar phase, the system uses the unified S-band system, which measures three-way Doppler, range, and two angles. In lunar orbit, the system uses the unified S-band measuring three-way Doppler. Outbound or onboard derived navigational data is sent by telemetry to MSFN. The radar tracking data and telemeter data are piped into the mission control center here, and the guidance and navigation parameters are then computed in the RTCC, the real-time computation center. After the guidance and navigation data is determined, it is telemetered to the Apollo guidance computer aboard the spacecraft through the up data link that I indicated by a black box before. Of course, it could also be transmitted by voice and entered through the disky by the astronaut. These are the measurement uncertainties of the MSFN system. Here we assume the system is operating in the three-way Doppler mode with one 85-foot station transmitting and two stations receiving. We assume an uncertainty, a one sigma uncertainty in the location of this station in latitude and longitude to be 1 to 6 arc seconds. The altitude error is assumed to be 100 to 200 feet. The uncertainty of the gravitational constant, the one sigma uncertainty, for the Earth is assumed to be 106 times 10 to the 9th feet cubed per second squared, and for the Moon, 6 times 10 to the 9th feet cubed per second squared. In the orbit determination program, the parameters estimated are 3 components of velocity, 3 components of position, and 2 three-way Doppler biases. Using all of the assumptions that I've now cited here, we ran a computer program, and I'll discuss the performance of the system shortly. I want to first discuss what the onboard system assumptions are. We might look at the techniques by which navigation is performed on board. One technique is shown here. A star is picked up with a scanning telescope and centered, at which time the astronaut shifts to the sextant, which is a 28 power narrow field of vision instrument, and he superimposes the star over the landmark. Now, this particular slide shows a star, which is kind of hard to see right here, superimposed over the Golden Gate Bridge. When the star and landmark are superimposed, all the astronaut does is press a button, and the angles between the two is entered automatically into the computer. In Earth orbit, the astronaut can measure his position by tracking known landmarks, which are entered into the Keplerian equations, which the computer uses. It is also possible, since one knows the error propagating equations, to track unknown landmarks and to compute his position accurately in Earth orbit and in lunar orbit. At the same time, the computer also computes, in this particular instance, the latitude and longitude, the geographic position of the unknown landmark. When the Apollo program was initiated, it was planned to use known landmarks, and navigation would be performed in this way. But during the many Gemini missions, we've observed that in many instances, a large percentage of the Earth's surface has been covered with clouds, and it has been sometimes difficult to plan ahead of time precisely what landmarks one would want to use. Greater reliance will no doubt be placed on the unknown landmark method of navigating, although there's a penalty there in that it takes a few more sightings, which in turn translates itself into RCS fuel, which is one of the factors which goes into the overall decision-making process of precisely what sort of techniques he will use. This shows a diagram of measuring a navigational fix in cislunar space. Here we've used the stars Fomalhaut, Deneb, and Antares. The lunar horizon is used with Antares, and navigational landmarks are used with Fomalhaut and Deneb in this particular representation. The intersection of two cones forms a line in space, and the intersection of a third cone forms a point in space. Now, we don't compute fixes in this way, however. Apollo does not use the conventional method that's been used by mariners since time immemorial, where you take discrete fixes and you adjust the time of these sites to give a known fix at a specific known point in time. This is the deterministic technique Apollo uses in the computer programs. It uses recursive navigation techniques, which relies on Kalman-Filler theory. Under this concept, the accuracy of position and velocity determination is improved as more and more sightings are taken, and the uncertainties are reduced as time goes on. The weighting functions are used, and the importance to be placed on a particular sighting is handled as part of the computational routine of the computer. Another form of navigation originally planned for Apollo is shown here. We can still do this technique. However, the early Apollo spacecraft will not have a horizon photometer and a star tracker to measure a discrete level of air glow at 100,000 feet, for example, as shown here. But this is the basic technique is very similar to marine navigation, or air navigation, where one takes an angle between the horizon and the star, and this gives a line of position. And with this technique, and taking more than one sighting, one can determine its precise position. The horizon photometer and the star tracker electronics were giving us some degree of difficulty in development, and so we removed this from the early spacecraft, and that particular navigational scheme will be tested as an experiment as the program progresses. These are is a listing of what assumptions we now make concerning the performance of the onboard system used in the ways that have been cited. In the Earth orbital phase, scanning telescope uncertainties are 4 milliradians, and landmark position uncertainties assumed to be 1,000 feet. During the translunar and trans-Earth phases, the sextant uncertainty is 10 arc seconds, and the uncertainties in the horizon are 1 nautical mile for the Earth and 0.5 nautical mile for the Moon. Additionally, we assume that 40 landmark sightings are made en route to the Moon and en route back to Earth. The velocity corrections made en route to the Moon and returning to the Earth are accurate in magnitude to 1%. The pointing of the thrust vector itself is accurate in to 10 milliradians. This continues with the assumptions on the onboard system. In lunar orbital phase, the scanning telescope uncertainty is 4 milliradians. Landmark position uncertainties, 1,000 to 5,500 feet in a horizontal position, 2,300 to 3,000 feet in vertical position, in vertical direction. Let's look now at the comparison of the MSFN and onboard navigational uncertainties using the assumptions for both systems cited previously. During the translunar phase, except for the position, at the second mid-course, the greatest error is accumulated for both the onboard and the MSFN system. In terms of velocity, the greatest error in the MSFN system is at the ship, at the injection point. In terms of velocity, otherwise, it's at the perilune point. In lunar orbit, the accuracies are reasonably good and comparable in both systems. And trans-Earth performance is shown here, where at the entry point, the onboard system has an error of about 9 miles. The MSFN position, now we're
working back closer to the MSFN.
This is a little bit better representation of the same information to show the performance in position uncertainty in nautical miles as a function of time, and MCC is not Mission Control Center here. It means mid-course correction. And this is the MSFN. This is the onboard system. In velocity, feet per second, time. Also showing the points at which the mid-course corrections are made. The MSFN system is more accurate until about 35 hours after the spacecraft is injected toward the moon. At that time, the onboard system is somewhat more accurate. This shows some reasonably surprising results with respect to the position and velocity uncertainties in lunar orbit. The position inaccuracies, uncertainties as a function of time, are shown above for the onboard system and for the MSFN. And similarly, the velocity uncertainties as a function of time from insertion into lunar orbit for both the onboard system and the MSFN. These timelines show the areas in which the MSFN is tracking and also during which the scanning telescope is sighting lunar landmarks. This shows the mid-course velocity performance during the translunar phase. The bottom plot shows the feet per second uncertainty and velocity correction, which would be made as a function of time from injection to the first velocity correction as measured by the MSFN and as measured by the onboard system. The upper of the two figures shows the sum of the first two velocity corrections. You can see there's a significant velocity saving by using the MSFN system. These figures also show that it's worthwhile to delay from a fuel standpoint before making the velocity corrections. These figures are somewhat indicative of fuel economies, which could be made as the uncertainties in velocity corrections are reduced. This shows in simplified form the interface between the ground and the onboard systems. The computations, of course, for the MSFN are made at the Mission Control Center. The interface with the computer is made via the two routes, the up data link, the up and down data link to the guidance computer, and voice communication through the crew, through the disky, into the guidance computer. The computer updata rate is 10 uplink words per second. The total navigation updata information required is a state vector consisting of 6 components and time. The updata frequency required is once prior to each guidance maneuver. Total transmission time is 60 seconds maximum for a 99% probability of no errors. The navigational update information is updata information is not time critical. The end result of the lunar mission is a safe reentry into the Earth's atmosphere. The reentry problem is depicted pictorially here. The guidance system must hit a corridor approximately 26 miles deep. This accuracy is obtained in 2 or 3 mid-course corrections during the return flight from the moon. Prior to entering the Earth's atmosphere, the service module is jettisoned. If the spacecraft comes in too high in this entry corridor, too little energy will be transferred from the vehicle to the atmosphere, and the spacecraft will enter a highly elliptical Earth orbit. The eccentricity of this orbit is a function of how far above the upper entry corridor the entry is actually made. Since there's no significant propulsion aboard the command module other than the 100-pound RCS system, there would be no way for the astronaut to recover from this highly elliptical orbit. So it's necessary that this entry corridor be hit. If they come in too low, the heat shield tolerances or the heat shield safety margins are likely to be exceeded and the vehicle will burn up. So one of the critical phases of the mission from a guidance control standpoint is the entry phase. In Apollo, the Earth's atmosphere is entered by making one skip. The total range of the vehicle from the point of entry is nominally 2,500 miles. No propulsion system is used to remove energy from the vehicle. All of the energy is removed by the atmosphere. And we expect to land as close to the ship after the lunar mission as we have been doing in the Gemini program. A typical Apollo entry trajectory is shown very simplified form in this diagram. At some time prior to entry, the entry vehicle is separated from the service module and aligned to the entry attitude. The IMU is aligned and the navigational system is updated for the last time. The initial bank angle depends upon whether the vehicle is entering at the top of the corridor or at the bottom. If the spacecraft is entering close to the top of the corridor, the bank angle will be such that the lift is directed downwards in the vertical plane. Otherwise, the lift is directed upwards in the vertical plane. Upon encountering the sensible atmosphere, the remaining phases of the trajectory are, one, an initial phase during which safe capture is ensured and excessive accelerations are avoided. Two, a second phase during which the vehicle is steered so that the final phase will be able to guide the spacecraft to the target. Three, a ballistic lob phase, which may be bypassed if the target is short. And the final phase during which the spacecraft is steered to the target. This usually consists of 600 to 800 miles and is quite similar to entry from low orbit about the Earth. The entry of a spacecraft near parabolic velocities presents a number of sources of danger to the crew. The chief of these dangers are excessive accelerations and exiting along a trajectory which would exceed the lifetime of the onboard systems. It is desirable to have an independent and reliable system for monitoring the primary guidance system. The entry monitoring system, which in the command module is built by Autonetics under IDWA to Space and Information Systems Division, must be sufficiently accurate to detect impending unacceptable trajectory characteristics such as excessive accelerations or an uncontrolled atmospheric skip in sufficient time to prevent the occurrence of these things. The EMS must not necessarily restrict the performance of the primary guidance system, and it must be at least an order of magnitude more reliable than the primary guidance system. Obviously, then, something must be relinquished in order to achieve this sort of a system. In this case, the capability for precise range control is relinquished. But the system is still capable of gross range control. The EMS consists of four basic parts. One is an entry threshold indicator. Two is a corridor indicator. Three, a bank indicator. And four, a flight monitor. The entry threshold indicator is an on-off signal that is excited when the sensed acceleration is greater than some nominal value. The corridor indicator consists of two signals which are used to indicate whether the entry is at the top or the bottom of the corridor. The signals result from comparing the sensed acceleration to a nominal mid-corridor value at a discrete time interval after the threshold indicator is turned on. The bank attitude indicator is a meter which indicates angular rotation about the approximate stability axes. The flight monitor in the command module is a rectilinear plotter which presents a trace of the variation of total acceleration with the velocity of the vehicle. The astronaut compares the trace with information which is presented on the face of this plotter. Two families of curves are shown here. One family serves to indicate the acceleration limit, indicates if the acceleration limit is being exceeded, and the second family is used to warn of an uncontrollable skip from the atmosphere. The high G lines, shown in solid, are of interest only if the vehicle is not at zero bank angle. Whenever there is a danger of excessive accelerations, the vehicle should be rolled to the zero bank angle. The second family of curves are the most important since they are used to prevent an uncontrollable skip. For every combination of the acceleration and velocity, there exists a limiting rate at which safe atmospheric exits can be made. If the flight trace is compared to these rays, a safe limiting exit rate can be defined by tangency of the actual flight trace and the ray, and what one sees as he flies the mission. And we've flown a number of these missions here and at North American, is a trace nominally reasonably tangent to these exit rays as time progresses during the time you're making the entry. Originally, these traces, these exit rays, by the way, were straight as they're shown in this slide, but actually there are times, we found that there are times when the flight monitor would indicate a failure erroneously, and this deficiency has partially been overcome by redefining the rays as curve lines and by shaping the entry trajectory so that a violation of the tangency criteria was more easily to determine. The EMS is a new approach toward guidance during reentry, and seeing all the improvements in recent years in guidance and control kind of reminds me of a story of something that happened in the vicinity of the manned spacecraft center to me. My family and I were taking a drive around here not long after we arrived, and of course it's a booming area, as you can see. And we were driving around the countryside on a Sunday, and I saw an old gentleman sitting on the front porch in a rocking chair. And I walked up to try to find out where we were and trying to find out more about the area, and I said, "Sir, you must have seen a great many changes during your many years around here." And he said, "Yes, I'm 100 years old. I've seen lots of changes, and I've been again every one of them." Fortunately, the people who designed the EMS weren't that way.
Yes, like it.
No comments allowed from up here. I'd like to discuss the LEM guidance and control system very briefly. This is a simplified block diagram of it. It's quite similar to the command module system, although the nomenclature is somewhat different. Rather than trying to go through it, I might indicate that it has two control paths. It has two guidance systems. The system that I've described in some detail, which is shown here, is the GNN system, and another system, the abort guidance system. This is the abort electronics assembly. And where is the rest of the abort guidance system? It's not shown, I guess. The abort guidance system is the responsibility of Grumman. It's a strap-down system. the first major inertial application of strap-down inertial techniques. It's subcontracted to TRW, and in turn, the sensor package, the abort sensor assembly, is subcontracted to United Aircraft, the corporate systems center of United Aircraft. Of course, as part of the guidance and control system, the rendezvous radar, a very important element of the system, and the landing radar, another very important element of the system. The rendezvous will be discussed in considerable detail in a later paper. I won't mention much of it here. The landing will be discussed in considerable detail in the paper by Don Cheatham later this afternoon. So I'll not go into that in any detail. This shows a more simplified diagram of the LEM stabilization and control system involving the radar, the GNN system, the SCS system, or the S&C system, the reaction control system, and the propulsive system. Of course, we have the two engines, the descent engine and the ascent engine. This shows the current configuration of the LEM cockpit. And as I mentioned, the astronaut is the most important element of the guidance and control system, and this is particularly true in the LEM. The two windows shown, and you can just see the corners of them, one here, the one on the left is for the command pilot, and the one on the right is for the pilot. There are two FDAIs right in the middle, the eight ball. Immediately above the FDAIs are pointers which indicate translation of velocities. There's the delta V counter, the throttle setting indicator, and propellant quantity gauges. In the upper portion of the panels are the main propulsive system and environmental control system, control switches, and indicators. Below the FDAI are various subsystem control switches, a vertical velocity indicator, and a thrust-to-weight ratio indicator. Down low, you can see the DISCI and the DITA, which is like a DISCI, which enables the pilot to communicate with the abort guidance system computer, which is somewhat of a simplified system that has the capability for abort only in the event of difficulty with the primary system. It only has 4,000 words of memory. It doesn't have the flexibility, the broad flexibility and capability of the primary system. Owen mentioned some of the characteristics of the trajectory from the lunar surface, from orbit down to the lunar surface. I'd like to restate these very briefly. The command module, the service module, and the LEM are initially in an 80-mile circular orbit. The velocity of this orbit, about 6,000 feet per second. Its period, about 2 hours. This means you're behind the moon about 1 hour out of every two. Of course, the onboard system is of great importance during that particular hour. At such times as a vehicle reaches the proper point for entry, an impulse of approximately 100 feet per second is applied by the descent engine. It's actually shown in the nominal case here to be 98 feet per second. After the vehicle has traversed roughly 180 degrees around the moon, it reaches a perilune of 50,000 feet. The trajectory is monitored by the astronauts in the LEM tracking the command module and by checking out the landing radar at an altitude as shown here of about 70,000 feet. Also, it's monitored by the astronaut in the command module who tracks the LEM through the optical system of the command module. The next phase of the landing maneuver is shown in the next slide. And here we cover about 240 to 250 miles across the lunar surface. This is the point from 50,000 feet down to the Highgate point, which is in the vicinity of 8,600 feet or 10,000 feet or thereabouts. Here the LEM descent engine has been on for a period of about 450 seconds. After completion of this phase, the vehicle, the LEM, enters the Highgate point right there. from that point on down is the constant attitude phase, during which the astronaut is he's suddenly about 2 miles above the surface. He suddenly pitches up and is able to see his landing point. He's making maybe 500 miles an hour and what feels like straight down, and he's going to be on the ground very shortly. During this particular phase of the mission, he chooses out his particular landing point based upon reconnaissance that he performs as he proceeds downward. To enable the landing to be efficiently made fuel-wise, he has a landing point designator, which is nothing more than a reticle on the windshield that he lines up over the desired landing point, and automatically his system carries him in that direction. When he gets down to an altitude of 700 feet to 1,000 feet, he takes over manually and flies the vehicle in the rest of the way manually. The handling qualities of the limb will be discussed in greater detail later. The limb handles much like an airplane. Its handling qualities are a little bit on the marginal side, but with a little training, it's comfortable to the pilot. And we've made maybe 1,000 landings in our simulators here. The pilots begin to feel comfortable after 2 or 3, but it does feel a little bit mushy at the beginning, partially due to the fact that we're not quite getting full thrust out of our RCS thrusters, partially due to the fact that it'd be nice to have a little bit longer moment arms for these, but there's no room for them. But the vehicle handles very well, and it's very crisp. At the touchdown point, well, one of the indications of how we are building the margins of safety into the vehicle, we of course never know, and we still don't know, how good the pilot's visibility will be during the final moments near touchdown. The surveyor results have been optimistic. We can still make the touchdown very easily on instruments, because at about 100 feet, at the point where where there's no dust problem, we'll use the landing radar to null out all drifts which have accumulated in the platform system. And from that point on down, the landing can be made on instruments. And if he can see out the window and his visual cues are better, he can make them visually. If his translational velocity exceeds 4 feet per second, or if his vertical velocity exceeds about 10 feet per second, then he's on the boundary margins for the design of the landing gear. We've shown that in our landings here and at Grumman that it's only about once out of 1,000 times that anyone has ever exceeded that sort of criteria in the system as it's now evolved. If he should land in the crater and his vehicle starts to tip over as he touches down in the crater, as long as as he doesn't tip over more than 45 degrees, he can press a button and get out of there. The thing seems to work in slow motion around the surface of the moon. Our simulations have shown there's adequate time for the pilot to determine what's happening. There's adequate time for the pilot to respond. Also, if he starts to sink into the surface, which now appears to be unlikely, he can do the same. As a matter of fact, the descent stage is much like a boat, because at that stage of the game, it's nothing but a fuel tank, which is empty, or near empty, and he's likely to float. But the landing gear criteria, the landing gear design, the pad design, is such that the stresses that will be encountered are of the order of the surveyor system, and we've already seen that there's no problem in a particular landing area with respect to the vehicle sinking in there. But even if worse should come to worst, and he starts to sink in, the pilot can get out of there, and the system is built such that the pilot response is such that he can recover himself. These are parts of the conservative systems philosophy that has been built in. I'd like to discuss very briefly the reliability criteria for the overall mission. Two reliability criteria are applied, of course, in mission planning. One is crew safety criteria, and the other is mission success criteria. This shows the crew safety block diagram for navigation and guidance and for control. In the navigation and guidance system, both the onboard system and the ground system are in parallel. The ground system consists of the mission control center, the communication systems, and the tracking network. The onboard system consists of the computer, the optics telescope, and the IMU. In the control system, there's even greater redundancy. From the crew safety standpoint, the computer and inertial measurement unit are connected in parallel with the body-mounted attitude gyros and accelerometers. Also in parallel are the sextant and scanning telescope, operating automatically or manually, and dual thrust vector control electronics and dual reaction jet electronics. The mission criteria for crew safety is such that if sufficient equipment malfunctions have occurred, that one more malfunction would endanger the crew, then the mission would be aborted. The reliability numbers and the concept that we now expect is that we would expect potential danger to a crew once in about 200 missions. This shows the mission success criteria, and of course, things are more in series in guidance and control in the mission success than in the crew safety. The probability of mission success, of course, is somewhat less than that for crew safety. I think I've got the program 15 minutes behind schedule, and see my boss staring at me. Start quit.
Okay, thank you, Cliff. We might entertain one or two very brief, succinct, obviously pertinent questions before we move on to the next. Actually, in a sense, this discussion is a background setter, because this is now the guidance capability we're talking about, and it will, and the guidance system we're talking about, it'll enter in now to several of the other talks in terms of the use, the error analyses that are involved in the talks, and so on.